Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 485. This has been recorded on November 14th of the year 2004. It is my pleasure and privilege to present journalist Robert Perry of Consortium News, an individual who's covered a great many stories for many years, both for Consortium and for other news outlets. And we're going to be talking about some of the issues that figured in the recent election and its aftermath. Robert, welcome once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you.
You have worn the moniker of, according to the Washington Post, a spreadsheet-wielding conspiracy theorist, which I thought was a really, not only unfair, but remarkable appellation to hang on you in light of the work that you've done over the years for Consortium and other outlets. And the source of the irritation at the Washington Post was your reporting on some very serious anomalies in the electoral results that were just returned in early November. I wonder if you could summarize for us and encapsulate what the thrust of your stories were, and then perhaps respond and comment on how the Post and other outlets have tarred and feathered you.
Well, I'm not sure they've tarred and feathered us. I think what happened is that after the election on November 2nd, we started writing some stories more focused on the future about what would need to be done in terms of addressing, I think, especially the media imbalance in the United States. In doing that, we started receiving emails from some readers saying, "Why aren't you looking at these questions of anomalies in the actual vote tally on November 2nd rather than looking to the future? Why don't you look at what actually happened?" So we took that to heart, and we did a few stories that dealt with the November 2nd election. One that I did was focused on the at least the theoretical potential of how you would hack into election computers if that were done. I'd done a good deal of work in the 90s on what the Central Intelligence Agency called information warfare. It's also known as cyber war. And so I knew a good deal about the capabilities of getting into computers using those kinds of means. Now, I also wrote that there's no evidence that happened here, and there's really no evidence that theoretical possibility could be applied as broadly as would be needed to go into computers all around the U.S. And try to alter vote tallies. So we did that. We also had a story that actually my son Sam did, which is the one I think you're referring to, which looked at unusual aspects of the vote tallies in Florida, where in many counties, including many of the Democratic counties in South Florida and also in Central Florida, Bush's totals were surprisingly high when one considers how many new Democrats had been registered. His tallies exceeded the number of registered Republicans, which certainly can happen, but is unusual, especially in close elections. So that was the point we were making, was that there was evidence out there, there were reasons and certainly broad suspicions among the American people to warrant at least some kind of checking to see if there had been any sort of more broad interference with the actual vote tallies. And that was a story we did, and I guess as the Washington Post, in looking around for places to criticize for not just accepting the results, picked us as one of them and did a story which mentioned us. And my son Sam, who had done the original piece on the on the spreadsheets, responded to it.
One of the points that you made, you actually quoted Republican pollster Dick Morris, and he noted the extraordinary discrepancy between the actual electoral results and the exit polls. I wonder if you could perhaps cover that for us.
Right. One of the things that I was hearing on November 2nd, real time, was the information from the exit polls that this consortium of networks and other news organizations had put together. And obviously, exit polls can be slightly imperfect, but they're awfully good, and almost never are they significantly wrong. As Dick Morris, the Republican pollster, pointed out in a column he wrote for the Hill newspaper, that it's unheard of for exit polls to be wrong, since what they do is they're actually taken from people who actually voted, as opposed to pre-election polls, which we have to sort of figure out, is this person likely to vote? in the case of exit polls, you know the person voted. So you're just asking them how they voted, and you're sampling a reasonable number of people to get what's happening throughout the state or throughout the country. And the polls were showing, those exit polls were showing that that Kerry was winning virtually every battleground state, including Florida and Ohio and Iowa, and actually a total of six of them that were later given to Bush. So and on the national level, Kerry was winning at about a 51% to 48% rate. So what Morris said in his column was that this is just impossible to have that number of mistakes in exit polls. He then propounded what I would consider a conspiracy theory that it must have been that the exit pollsters were trying to get it wrong to somehow benefit Kerry. But obviously that didn't happen. The networks did not call any of these states for Kerry. They waited and saw these different results coming in from what they were expecting. But no one fired prematurely on calling a state. So what we saw here was there's certainly reason to be suspicious. As Morris pointed out, exit polls around the world are used to test against voter fraud. That when in Mexico, he pointed out that he did the polls for a race between Vicente Fox and the PRI, the longstanding government party. And when the exit poll showed Fox winning by about 7%, Morris leaked that information to create a momentum to prevent the PRI from then stepping in and altering the vote tallies, and that succeeded. So he was saying that the same kinds of rules would suggest that, or the same kind of theory would suggest that it's really impossible for the poll results, the exit poll results to be that divergent from the actual tallies in the U.S. too.
A number of journalists have noted attempts at eliminating potential Democratic voters, in particular African Americans, people allegedly with criminal backgrounds from the rolls. Another factor that has entered into a lot of people's cynicism or skepticism about the results concerns Diebold and ESNS. This isn't something you focus on to a great extent in your work, but you did bring it up. I wonder if you could touch on that for us.
Well, there have been a number of new systems put in to count votes and to tally votes, and many of them are these touchscreen systems, which we happen to use in Arlington, Virginia, where I live. And they're very neat to use, and they're very easy to use. And in some ways, they do eliminate chances of error because at the end of the process, it comes up and says you want to vote for, and they list to you how you're supposed to have done. So if you see it wrong, you could change it. And that's obviously an improvement in some ways over the old systems of the punch cards and so forth, which might not function properly. But with that, since they lack paper, there's no way to really ascertain that if something happens in the computer, either intentionally or accidentally, that the numbers might not be thrown off. And that has led to a great deal of suspicion, especially in the sense of Diebold, which I think has in like 70,000 these units around the country. The CEO of Diebold made a very strong pitch on behalf of President Bush, and said in a fundraising letter that he would do everything he could to assure that Bush got the electoral votes in Ohio.
This, by the way, was a fellow named Wally O'Dell or Walden O'Dell. Go ahead.
Right. Yes, Mr. O'Dell is a strong supporter of President Bush, and. He later said he regretted the choice of the words when there were press accounts about it, but it certainly raised some suspicions. Some Democrats also were curious as to why Republicans were so resistant to efforts to set up paper backups of those paperless ballots. Some are now being changed for 2006 or for the next presidential election, but they were not really fixed in that sense for the 2004 election. So we had this situation where there were perhaps unnecessary suspicions that would be left open by the fact that there was a political agenda for some of the executives whose machines were counting the votes in ways that couldn't really be checked very easily.
Something you touched on, and we're going to get to the subject of John Kerry and some articles that have appeared in Consortium, also an article you wrote for Salon.com about his role in investigating something that you were quite heroic in looking into, namely the Contra drug traffic. But before we get to that, Robert, there's something I wanted to touch on briefly, a little bit of a digression, but you talked about Dick Morris and how he said, well, the exit pollsters were trying to deliberately slant the results in favor of Kerry. You also noted that the various media outlets did not do what he was theorizing that the pollsters were aiming at precipitating. One of those subjects you've covered a great deal in Consortium News, and by the way, listeners are strongly encouraged to visit their website at www.consortiumnews.com. We'll talk about that later. But the myth of the liberal news media, we hear this constantly, the liberal news media, and yet as you point out, the red states, the heartland of America, are inundated almost constantly with nothing but right-wing, highly slanted media coverage. I wonder if you could develop the myth of the liberal media and some of your conclusions about what is going to be needed in order to restore a measure of balance to the American political spectrum.
Well, I've been in Washington for 27 years as a journalist. I started with the Associated Press, which of course is a very mainstream news organization, perhaps the epitome of mainstream news organizations. And I worked there for about 13 years, including many of them in Washington. That's where I did some of my early work on what became the Iran-Contra scandal. I worked at Newsweek for several years. I worked for Public Broadcasting's Frontline program. And most recently, I was an editor at Bloomberg News, handling corporate scandals and securities regulation issues. So my history has been really fairly much in the Washington news media, and I can say flatly that I have never seen this liberal media that people talk about. What you see is a mainstream media that is often corporate in nature. Many of the executives at the highest levels are much more Republican oriented than Democratic oriented. Some are very vocal and some are very conservative, like Jack Welch, who was longtime CEO of General Electric, which owns NBC and MSNBC. At AP, we had our general manager when I was doing my work in the 1980s was named Keith Fuller, and he would give speeches, very laudatory speeches about President Reagan and what he had done for the country. So the idea that there's this liberal media is really a myth. What the conservatives often will point to, they'll say, well, you know, the average, more reporters will vote Democratic than Republican. They'll cite certain surveys, which may or may not be very good surveys, but that's what they say. And the problem with that theory, though, is that the beat reporters really don't get to decide much. Beat reporters are just regular working stiffs, basically. The people that decide are the owners, the executives, the senior editors, who the executives and owners appoint. They get to decide who covers what, how, what the take the newspaper or the TV station will have on a different story. So what you're really getting is in the mainstream press, kind of a mixed bag of sometimes very good, straightforward journalism, sometimes consciously centrist journalism, and sometimes tilted slightly to the right, but very rarely do you see it really tilted to the left. In fact, I didn't see that much at all when I was at any of the news organizations I've been at. So what I think you also have, which has developed out of the late 70s, is a very aggressive and increasingly well-financed conservative media, which began as sort of a counterpoint to the mainstream press. After Watergate, after the Vietnam War, there was an effort by the conservatives, in their view, to achieve a better balance between a media that was, they thought, kind of going after people like Richard Nixon, being too critical of the war in Vietnam. And so they started investing heavily in a media that would present more conservative viewpoints. And we saw that evolving through magazines and then newspapers like the Washington Times, later the AM radio talk show domination by conservatives, Fox News, a very much a conservative-oriented cable news network. So while you're seeing the mainstream press sort of moving generally to the right slightly, you've also seen the building of this very conservative media, which is ideologically conservative. there really isn't much of anything on the left. You might find in the Nation magazine or these underfunded, small circulation publications that very few people really read. So what you've got is it's a tremendous imbalance that has developed really over the last quarter century or so, with much more conservative-oriented media in the United States than anything even centrist or liberal, while you still hear the myth of the liberal media, but it's just not founded in reality.
One of the things, too, and we're going to talk about some of your experiences with this very, quote, liberal, unquote, media establishment in the 80s. But, of course, one of the things that is also driving the political spectrum is the medium in which I work, namely talk radio. I wonder if you could comment briefly on that.
Well, I mean, it's pretty clear that talk radio is dominated by conservatives. I mean, the only thing is even the conservatives don't dispute that. As much as they try to pretend there's this vast liberal media somewhere, which and they'll point to certain liberals in the media, but that really is more of an anomaly than it is anything that is a pattern. But certainly with talk radio, anyone who gets in the car and drives across the central parts of the United States, or for that matter any part of the United States, will find tuning into the AM dial conservative message after conservative message. Some of it's more political, the Rush Limbaugh kind of conservatism, or you may find Christian conservatism being broadcast on some other stations, but the liberal opinion on the AM dial is virtually non-existent. There's been this effort, which actually began, that started up in March of 2004 to have Air America Radio, which is a kind of liberal alternative in the talk radio field, and it has pretty much stumbled out of the blocks. It had trouble with its financing. It was taken off the air a number of cities because it didn't have the necessary financial support. But it has, has offered in certain cities some alternative, and apparently it's doing very well in terms of its listenership in the cities where it has appeared. But it's certainly no match for the domination that the Rush Limbaughs and the many others like him have held over AM talk radio across the United States.
Something that I think acts as something of a signature to that, you alluded to the fact that after Watergate there was a big drive by the right wing to create their own media establishment to counter what they saw as a liberal media establishment. Well, of course, one of the central players in the actual Watergate street-level operations was G. Gordon Liddy, who's now a major talk show host. And also in another of the imbroglios that the conservatives did not want to get kicked around, namely the Iran-Contra affair, none other than Oliver North himself is now a talk show host. The Iran-Contra affair was one of the subjects that you walked point on in breaking journalistically, Robert. I wonder if you'd relate yours and Mr. Barge's experiences in that regard.
Well, I actually got to know Ollie North fairly early on because In the early part of the 1980s, I was assigned by the AP to be on their special assignment team, their investigative unit. And one of the stories I sort of thought we should look at was the policy that was evolving towards Central America and the changes that were occurring inside the CIA under the new director, Bill Casey. There was obviously a more aggressive approach being taken by the Reagan administration toward both issues, both the agents, both the CIA and Central America. So those stories, which I began doing in 81, eventually led me to conclude that there was also an effort to misrepresent a lot of information to the American people, sort of a propaganda operation that the Reagan-Bush administration was undertaking in support of its policies. That was unusual. I mean, not that our governments haven't engaged in propaganda before, but this was a very organized and aggressive effort to bring the media into line on how the American people were supposed to see Central America and those conflicts there. And that led me eventually to stumble upon the existence of Oliver North's operations. At the time, the Nicaraguan Contras, which was the rebel force being supported initially by the CIA, had its money cut by Congress, which was then controlled by the Democrats. And North and others in the White House, including then Vice President George H.W. Bush, and also elements of the CIA, secretly began in contravention of the law to provide additional support for the Contras through various third countries and various back channels. North even set up a little air force that was dropping supplies to the Nicaraguan Contras in the countryside. So this was happening, a dramatic story happening behind the scenes in the United States government. We, at AP, we tried to, you know, lead the way on this, mostly because the New York Times and the Washington Post were really running for cover. The major news organizations weren't willing to take on Reagan at that point, especially after 84 when he won a resounding re-election. So we were kind of out there. And I did the first story mentioning North in June of 85. Brian Barger was brought on by the AP to sort of work on the investigation with me. And that led us in trying to figure out how the Contras were keeping themselves afloat. We also stumbled upon the involvement of a number of Contra units in drug trafficking. And we did the original Contra drug story in December of 85. That then led to an investigation by one senator in the U.S. Congress named John Kerry. He was the only senator who really had the nerve to take on the Reagan-Bush administration at its peak of power over an issue as sensitive as that.
One of the points that gets made often is that, quote, there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, and yet the subject that you've just touched upon, John Kerry's primary role in leading a congressional investigation of these very sordid activities and taking on the covert operations establishment, so to speak, and not only that, but doing so at a point in political time, so to speak, in which Reagan, as you've noted, was preeminent. It was viewed as reckless or perhaps even unpatriotic to assail Reagan at his zenith. And yet John Kerry did that politically. And you've written about that both in Consortium News and also in a very fine article in Salon.com. I wonder if you would develop John Kerry's role in investigating this and also the opposition that he faced, which was considerable.
Well, also I should mention that I just did this book, Secrecy and Privilege, entitled Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, which also goes through some of this material in more detail, how also the conservative media rose up in the late 70s, why it rose up, what we know now from the documents about why, about what they did and how they did it, and into the 80s. Obviously, as a reporter, what you really hate to see is unified government, just from a practical point of view of doing your work. It's nicer to have people that want to fight with each other because that makes it easier to get information that you can then develop into news stories. And that applies anyway. I mean, you never want to see, if you have a government that's all Democrat or all Republican, you're likely to have a harder time prying loose interesting stories. That said, there are obviously differences between Democrats and Republicans that are significant. I know there's a claim that we heard a lot, especially during the campaign 2000, that it didn't matter if Gore won or Bush won, and that was that was the argument that the Nader people were making quite aggressively. Clearly, there was a difference between what Gore would have done and what Bush would have done. And as I've often said, when you're dealing with the most powerful nation on Earth, one that's has more nuclear weapons than any country, is the largest economy that can project power in very destructive or creative and constructive ways around the world, the person in the White House is not insignificant. And even if the person has similar policies than the other guy, whether that person is better suited, more knowledgeable, has a better temperament, those kinds of issues can be of huge, huge importance to people around the world. In the coverage of Central America, there were real differences too. Back in the 80s, there were Democrats who felt that these were civil wars being fought, more or less local conflicts, and that there could be negotiations to resolve them, and that the awful bloodshed that was going on, with really tens, even hundreds of thousands of people dying, most of them being taken out and shot, not in battle, but being massacred, that this didn't have to happen. The view of the Reagan-Bush administration at the time was that this was an aspect of the Cold War, and that they followed the so-called Jean Kirkpatrick theory that once a country went communist, there was no way for it to come back or become democratic except through violence. That theory, which was popular in the 80s turned out obviously not to be true, as we saw the Eastern European countries become democratic and ultimately the Soviet Union itself become democratic, without the kind of violence that some people thought would have been necessary. So you really have differences. They're not necessarily only the differences that surround the issues of whether you favor Medicare or oppose Medicare, or whether you favor abortion rights or oppose abortion rights, that there are differences that relate to how the world is seen. And we've seen that as an issue these days, too, where the Bush administration has taken more of a view that that it's important to impose a kind of an ideological view over how you look at the Middle East, as opposed to a more practical one. That's where there's been enormous conflict with the CIA in this administration, where people in the agency have argued that you've got to deal with the real world, not with the world you would like it to be, but what's actually there. So even on issues of fact and how you respond to information, it becomes an important difference between sometimes the Republicans and the Democrats.
We have just a couple of minutes left on this side, Robert. John Kerry was actually walking point in the congressional investigation of the Contras, as you've noted. I wonder if you could just briefly encapsulate some of what he encountered, and then give some information about your website and your newly released book, and then we're going to continue this discussion on the other side. We're going to be bringing in Lucy Commissar. We're going to talk about the related BCCI investigation. John Kerry and the investigation of Contra cocaine.
Well, as I said, in late 85, we did the first story at AP. Kerry picked up on it in 86. He assigned members of his own staff to begin investigating. He was stonewalled aggressively by the Reagan-Bush administration. We now know that he was lied to about information that existed within the U.S. government that would have supported his investigation but was being protected. He was largely discredited by the Washington Press Corps. The New York Times made fun of his what he was doing. They didn't believe it. So did the Washington Post. So did the L.A. Times. So he was pretty much out there on his own trying to do this. After he did a very courageous report in 89 describing for the first time how the U.S. government had tolerated drug trafficking into the United States for a geopolitical reason, the Contra War, he was, the stories were buried about his report. They were put way inside newspapers, brief, dismissive stories. Newsweek called him a Randy conspiracy buff for his work. And then the story basically died until the mid-90s, when Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News revived it in a very controversial series called Dark Alliance. Gary Webb was then attacked by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, etc. But it did provoke the CIA to investigate. And the Inspector General of CIA, Frederick Kitts, did a fairly honest job. He did a thorough investigation, looked at it, and reported in 1998 that while he disputed some of aspects of Webb's series, that the overall point was correct,
mm-hmm.
that the Contras were deeply involved in drug trafficking, that it involved not just a few people, but dozens and dozens of operatives, and that the Reagan-Bush administration had hidden the facts and protected the drug traffickers because they didn't want to embarrass this, what they considered a very important national security program.
Absolutely. Robert, we are out of time on this side. We'll resume this topic of discussion inside to your website and your newly released book real quickly.
Well, you can go to consortiumnews.com for some stories. Also, Secrecy and Privilege can be obtained either from Amazon.com or from our own site. We sell it, which is secrecyandprivilege.com.
And we will be resuming our discussion with Robert Perry, and we're also going to bring in Lucy Commissar in Side 2 of this program. But this concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 485, conversation with Robert Perry and Lucy Commissar. This is being recorded on November 14th of the year 2004. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.